Well, on the subject of workers' conditions and workplace relations, business groups have launched a campaign to cut Sunday penalty rates across a range of sectors. You probably would have encountered this before. Here is the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry's Kate Carnell prosecuting that case.
The cost of opening can be absolutely prohibitive. And if those costs were reduced, small to medium businesses could employ more of our young people. Youth unemployment rates are amongst the highest they've been for a long time. This is a win for Australians and a win for our young people who want jobs.
Now, first blush, you might think this is the kind of thing the coalition government would be interested in, and I suppose it's probably true, but there is dissent within the ranks on that. One Liberal MP, at least, is not convinced. The member for the federal seat of Bowman in southern Queensland joins us. His name is Andrew Lemming, and he's a bit of a sceptic on this. Andrew, thank you very much for your time.
Well, Lute, great to be with you.
You don't accept that there is a prohibitive cost on business here?
There's a cost on business. It's not prohibitive. Business in my electorate will obviously, like most of Australia, tell you that these are high penalty rates, but the workers will also tell you that many of them are living close to the poverty line and desperately need those penalty rates. So there's an independent umpire in place. I think they need to make this decision with inputs from workers, from ACCI, the Small Business Council, but all of the Liberal Party members lining up to attack penalty rates and the Labor members lining up to defend them doesn't add much to public debate.
Right. Why do you think then that so many of your colleagues are lining up to attack penalty rates?
Well, I guess it's an article of faith historically that we've always looked at making business conditions and employment conditions as positive as possible to get people into work. But there is a counterbalancing argument about antisocial hours, weekends and public holidays. And I'm aware there's millions of individual cases that I can't pretend to, for a moment, fully understand. So at the moment, I'm conservative about this. I think there is a role for penalty rates in these situations. I'm interested in areas like healthcare and pharmacy, for instance. There is a concern there because I need to make sure people can access medicines on Sundays and that we don't see pharmacies, for instance, unable to open their doors. For restaurants, cafes, that's a different situation again. And in all service industries, ultimately, it's up to the business owner to decide if they want to charge the costs of staying open on a weekend.
Now, actually, I'm glad you mentioned health because I know you've got expertise in that. I do want to come back to that in a second if I can. But just before I leave the penalty rates conversation, are you, just to be clear what you're suggesting here, are you suggesting that the current IR system works as it is, at least on this question, and doesn't need to be dealt with? Or are you saying that there is simply a different reform we should be considering?
Look, penalty rates can be argued up and down, just like politician salaries, from a million different angles. But ultimately, at the moment, businesses operate in my area on weekends. I don't accept fully that there'd be a whole lot of new employment by reducing penalty rates. I accept that a lot of people on the breadline need them. So I'm just very cautious about being absolute. At the moment, I welcome input from community groups, from unions and from individuals working and earning penalty rates. But I just think as a politician, it's not terribly useful for me to just dive into one position and hold on to it simply because I'm a member of one particular political party.
Right, I understand that point. But when you say that you're not convinced that it would create new employment to remove these costs on business, you are disputing a fairly central tenet of free market thinking and of the Liberal Party's current philosophy.
Well, no. I mean, economics would also tell you that, tax incidence or reducing a payment like a penalty rate can either be pocketed by the person who would be paying it or it may lead to extra employment. But the answer is probably somewhere in between the two.
Do you think that the coalition has no appetite ultimately for industrial relations reform?
Look, there's plenty of my colleagues speaking eagerly wanting this to occur. So, yes, there's certainly appetite to discuss it publicly. And I think that's important in the public domain. But keep remembering that we have Fair Work Australia to make these determinations. And they need to be receiving submissions from all over the country, from people with all different backgrounds. And obviously, we'd be encouraging that to occur.
And you're happy with the work that Fair Work Australia is currently doing?
Well, in this area, they are the umpire. And I'm prepared to accept that they're going to make an informed decision.
Let's talk about health, because you're a trained doctor. You've had lots of actually really interesting experience when we look at your bio in remote and rural family medical practices, a lot with Indigenous communities as well. So there's a few things we could tease out there, but let's start with this GP co-payment that seems to be causing such a political headache for the government at the moment. In your experience, will that stop people from going to a doctor?
It definitely won't stop them going to a doctor. It won't affect access one iota. I know that's quite controversial, but doctors at the moment recognise that around 10% of their patients have absolutely no money and nor ability to pay, and they see those patients and give them full medical care. So let's not underestimate the flexibility and compassion of local GPs.
Well, should we be relying on that, patient, though? I mean, should it be up to the doctor to have to make that decision?
Yes, and they always have, and they always will. Governments don't come in and tell doctors what to charge. So in a situation where a co-payment is introduced, this is obviously for a GP to decide if that person can pay it. And obviously they're $2 better off if they do charge the co-pay. And that gives them some leg room there or some elbow room to be able to then see people for free because A, the co-payment is not mandatory, and B, the co-payment is not charged on nearly 97 items that aren't time-based. So people with severe chronic disease, of course, that are on a care plan, still see their GP with no co-payment charged. And same with team-based care, same with pregnancy visits, same with the reviews for chronic disease. They're all exempted from the co-payment.
We've heard, though, already stories emerging from New South Wales that people are going to emergency departments to avoid having to pay this, even though it's not yet legislated. Surely that points to a change in behaviour that's inevitable.
There's no doubt there might be some confusion because people might have thought it was in place already, but that information will rapidly suffuse through the community and that confusion will be cleared up. Look, there's nothing stopping a person walking down the street who right now can't find a bulk billing GP thinking they can't see a doctor. But in every case where they walk in the door, they're compassionately treated by the best health clinicians in the world. That won't change. Access won't change. But people who can afford to pay a modest contribution to keep Medicare sustainable will do that under these laws if passed. And if they do that, what we will then see is the Medical Research Future Fund in place. And you'll also see GPs nearly $400 million better off because they collect the extra $2.
I mentioned Indigenous Health. You've done some work in that area. Indigenous Health, of course, had a cut. Indigenous services generally, and Indigenous Health might lose somewhere in the order of about $90 million. Is that money that Indigenous Health can afford to lose?
Look, that's a relatively small amount in the nearly $1 billion Indigenous Health budget. Most of these centres are block funded, so they're not affected by the changes and the co-payments we just described. But what's most important of all is finding a way to engage Aboriginal Australia in various improvements in social determinants of health, getting them confident to see an Aboriginal health provider and getting them to come in the door, and none of that changes with the budget.
None of that costs money?
Well, none of that influences an Aboriginal person coming to see a clinician. So all of those services are still in place, as are those that deliver them.
Something that's been quite colourful in the last few days has been this public stoush between Malcolm Turnbull and Andrew Bolt. It caught me a little bit by surprise, and then to see quite a strong response from the coalition against Malcolm Turnbull, who had attacked Andrew Bolt. Why do people in the coalition care so much about Andrew Bolt's feelings?
Well, Andrew Bolt was very, very, strong-worded in his and strident in his criticism. I think everyone likes Malcolm Turnbull. Most of us are probably envious that we weren't invited to dinner. It would have been a fascinating conversation. But I just don't understand how a meeting between these two people should cause such a fuss. I mean, an utterly united coalition under our leader. We recognise the incredible job that Malcolm does with his portfolio, and to simply see him in action in question time is someone who's in complete control of his domain. So he's a great guy. It's great to have him on our side. And if he chooses to have dinner with Clive Palmer, all I can say is it'll be a pretty interesting conversation.
Right. So why do so many of your colleagues seem to care that he took a swipe at Andrew Bolt for criticising him for that?
Well, look, I think it was a touch unseemly, the comments initially from Andrew, and I don't think they added much to public discourse. But look, if there was a bit of a an exchange of pleasantries there, I guess that's just public life.
But it's the fact that the coalition cares so much that I'm worried about. Why do they care what a columnist thinks?
Well, Andrew Bolt is a man of pretty significant opinion. So, look, you'd have to ask my colleagues that. I found it singularly sort of an uninteresting event, save for the fact that you never know what Clive's going to say next, and I'm sure Malcolm had a fascinating insight into that by catching up with him.
Right, I'm interested in the insight it provides into the coalition's thinking, but you mentioned Clive and insights into what's in Clive's mind. Sometimes it's stuff that gets him into trouble, including his attack today on Peter Credlin, the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, saying she would get a massive benefit when she gets pregnant. Do you think he was right to backtrack from that, and should he go further and apologise in a more contrite way?
Look, it was a terrible thing to say, and I don't want to start casting judgment from my position, but at both a personal level and a professional level, it was just completely off beam. It's really up to the individual concerned whether they